All right, so are you ready to pop some corks? Because today's deep dive is it's taking us straight to the heart of a biblical celebration. The wedding at Cana. We're talking miracles, symbolism, maybe even a little mystery.
It's a story that's captivated people for centuries, sparking endless interpretations and debates.
Yeah, and you asked for the full breakdown, the significant the interpretations, even where this all might have gone down.
Right.
We've got excerpts from the Wedding at Cana Wikipedia article ready to go.
Okay.
So let's dive in.
Do it.
The story unfolds in Cana, Galilee during a wedding feast. Music, dance, the vibe.
Yeah.
But then oh, they run out of wine.
Oh, a major social fumble in that time and place.
Yeah.
It would have been a huge embarrassment for the host, reflecting poorly on their ability to provide for their guests.
Oh yeah, imagine the whispers, right? Not enough wine. What kind of celebration is this?
Exactly.
But luckily for the wedding party, Jesus and his disciples are there, along with his mother. And it's Mary. Imagine.
Which is interesting in itself, isn't it?
Yeah.
She approaches Jesus knowing he can do something, even telling the servants, do whatever he tells you, before he's even indicated what he'll do. Talk about confidence in your kid.
Yeah, she seems to have a sense of what he's capable of, even if others don't. And then there's that moment where Jesus responds to her with, "Woman." Now, we know this was a common way to address women back then, but.
But it's not just the word choice, it's the context.
Yeah.
He uses the same term woman again at the crucifixion.
Oh.
In these incredibly significant, emotionally charged moments, the term seems to carry a deeper weight.
Almost like he's highlighting the profound significance of their connection, particularly in those defining moments of his life and ministry.
Yeah.
So, what happens next? The scene is set with six stone jars, usually used for purification rituals, just kind of hanging around. Jesus tells the servants to fill them up with water, draw some out, and bring it to the steward in charge.
And here's where it gets really interesting. According to the Gospel of John, the steward had no clue where this wine came from. He's floored by how good it is, raving to the bridegroom. Everyone serves the good wine first and then the inferior wine after the guests have become drunk. But you have kept the good wine until now.
Okay, stop the presses. It's a good wine comment. That's not just about a tasty vintage, right? There's something more going on here.
Exactly. Some scholars believe it's a deliberate symbolic gesture. They see the good wine as a representation of the new covenant. Jesus brought, contrasting it with the old ways.
It's like a spiritual upgrade, trading in the old for something way better.
Precisely. And this idea that the good stuff comes later? It could also be a subtle nod towards the concept of salvation. Eternal life through Jesus' sacrifice is the ultimate good wine saved for last.
Yeah, that's a reason to celebrate. But before we get ahead of ourselves, let's talk about this miracle as an antitype. I have to admit, that term always throws me for a loop.
Yeah, it's a biblical studies term that essentially means a fulfillment or a contrast.
Right.
In this case, the miracle at Cana is seen as an antitype to Moses' first miracle turning water into blood.
That's right. Moses plagues the whole deal. But how does turning water into wine contrast with turning water into blood? What's the deeper meaning there?
It's a powerful juxtaposition. Moses' miracle was a sign of judgment, a precursor to the plagues that would eventually liberate the Israelites from slavery. Jesus, on the other hand, initiates his ministry with an act of abundance and joy.
Wow, I never thought about it like that. One represents liberation through hardship, the other through celebration and provision.
And the symbolism continues with what those substances represent. Blood often symbolizing death and sacrifice, and wine frequently symbolizing life and joy. It's almost as if Jesus is setting the tone for his ministry, hinting at the life-giving, joyful abundance he offers.
So we're not just talking about a party trick here. This miracle has layers.
Yeah.
I have to ask, where did this all go down? Was this Cana in Galilee actually in modern day Israel?
That's the million-dollar question.
Yes.
And it's not an easy one to answer. You see, there are actually a few places that claim to be the site of Jesus's first miracle.
Wait, really? Multiple contenders for the Cana crown? Yeah, tell me more.
The three main contenders are Kafr Cana, Kerbet Cana, and Cana Lebanon. Each site has its own set of arguments based on history, archaeology, and even tradition.
Okay, so let's break it down. What makes each of these places significant?
Well, Kafr Cana, located in modern-day Israel, has been associated with Cana since at least the 8th century. It's home to archaeological remains, including stone jars, similar to those described in the Bible.
Stone jars, you say? That seems like pretty compelling evidence.
It would be, except those types of jars were actually quite common in the first century. They
Oh.
were used for all sorts of things, not just wine. So while their presence is interesting, it's not definitive proof.
Okay, so maybe not a slam dunk. What about Kerbet Cana? What makes it a contender?
Well, Kibbutz Kana, also in Israel, is geographically closer to Nazareth, where Jesus grew up. Plus, its name is considered a closer linguistic match to the biblical Cana. And just to add to the intrigue, archaeologists have unearthed stone jars there, too.
So we've got stone jars at two locations, both vying for the title of Jesus's first miracle site. What about Kana, Lebanon? That seems pretty far off the beaten path.
Geographically, it is farther away. But during Jesus's time, the region it's located in was actually considered part of Galilee. And for many Lebanese Christians, particularly the Melkite Greek Catholics, this is the true site of Cana, a belief passed down through generations.
Wow, so we have three locations each with its own claim to fame. It seems like the jury's still out on the exact location.
It's exactly. Yeah. It's a great example of how history, archaeology, and faith often intertwine. Sometimes there's no single definitive answer, which just adds to the mystery and intrigue.
Absolutely. But speaking of mysteries and intrigue, remember how we were talking about the wine?
Yeah.
I've got a curveball for you. Some scholars believe that the wine at Cana might have actually been beer.
It's a theory that's gained some traction, yes. It hinges on the argument that the original Greek word used in the Bible, oinos, could also refer to a type of barley beer that was common in the ancient world.
Hold on, a beer miracle. Tell me more about this theory.
Proponents of this idea point out that beer was a staple beverage in many ancient cultures, particularly in regions where grapes weren't as readily available. They argue that the wine at the wedding could have been a type of weak, somewhat sour beer.
So not exactly the kind of craft brew we'd find today.
Not quite. It would have been a far cry from the refined beers we enjoy today.
So if beer was so common, why do most translations of the Bible use the word wine?
That's the main counterargument. Those who disagree with the beer theory emphasize that oinos is the word consistently used throughout the Bible when referring to wine. They argue that if the gospel writer meant beer, they would have used a different Greek word like sakera.
So it's a linguistic debate, essentially.
In many ways, yes. It all comes down to interpretation, cultural context, and even a bit of personal bias.
And to make things even more interesting, the Coptic Orthodox Church has its own take, believing the wine at Cana was non-alcoholic. It seems like everyone's trying to decipher the true nature of this drink and what it represents.
It highlights the fact that even seemingly straightforward stories from the past can be interpreted in vastly different ways. And that's part of what makes studying history and religion so fascinating.
Absolutely. No matter what was actually in those jars, one thing's for sure. The story of the wedding at Cana has had a lasting impact, reaching far beyond theological discussions. We see it depicted in art literature, even inspiring tales of other saints performing similar miracles.
It's true. The wedding at Cana has resonated throughout history, capturing the imagination of artists, writers, and theologians alike. One of the most famous examples is its depiction in countless paintings, from the works of Renaissance masters like Paolo Veronese to more modern interpretations.
It's amazing to see how different artists across time periods have visualized and interpreted this key moment in Jesus's ministry.
And then there are the literary connections. A notable example is the story of St. Columba, an Irish missionary who supposedly performed a very similar miracle, replenishing the sacramental wine during a mass.
Almost like a Celtic echo of the Cana story. It makes you wonder about the power of these tales to transcend time and geography.
It's fascinating, isn't it? But I think what intrigues me most about the wedding at Cana is what it reveals about Jesus. Here he is at the very beginning of his public ministry.
And his first big act is to save a party. What message is that sending? Yeah, it really makes you think about it. You'd think a grand entrance would involve something a bit more dramatic, right?
That's what's so striking about this miracle. You know, it's not a display of power in the face of opposition or anything. It's an act of quiet generosity within a celebration of human connection.
That's a good point. He's not like directly healing anyone or confronting authority figures. He's making sure a party can continue, that people can experience joy and abundance.
Exactly. And that, I believe, tells us something crucial about Jesus's ministry. Yes, he came to offer spiritual salvation, but he also cared about the human experience, about our joys and sorrows, about the simple act of sharing a meal and celebrating with those we love.
It makes you think about the kind of Messiah people were expecting versus who Jesus actually was, someone present in those everyday moments, engaging with people's needs and desires on a deeply personal level.
And that emphasis on abundance, that overflowing generosity, becomes a recurring theme in his ministry. Think about the feeding of the 5,000, the miraculous catches of fish. There's this constant sense that with Jesus, there's always more than enough to go around.
It's like he's offering us a glimpse into the kind of world he envisions, a world of radical abundance where no one is left wanting. It's a powerful message even thousands of years later.
It really is. And it all begins here at this wedding in Cana with this seemingly simple act of transforming the ordinary into something extraordinary.
So as we maybe raise a glass to the end of this deep dive, here's a thought for you to sip on. What resonates most with you about the wedding at Cana? Is it the miracle itself, the symbolism of the wine, the debates about its location, or what was actually in those jars?
Or perhaps it's the message of Jesus's radical generosity, his presence in those seemingly insignificant moments, and the reminder that joy and abundance are not just possibilities, but central to the world he envisions.
Whatever it may be, we hope this deep dive has given you plenty to ponder. Cheers to that.